It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about President Trump's tax returns, tensions over the GOP's health care bill, and more in our weekly roundup of national politics.
First, a report from the Wisconsin Elections Commission shows that dozens of 17-year-olds voted illegally in the presidential primary election last April, but it may have been because of confusion over voting laws.
The Elections Commission discussed the issue at a meeting yesterday where they also approved a plan to send postcards to nearly 800,000 voters in Wisconsin to tell them they'll be removed from the voter rolls if they don't update their information.
Laurel White covered the meeting for WPR News, and she joins us now for details. She's the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. Laurel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Laurel, let's start with that report of dozens of 17-year-olds illegally voting in Wisconsin's presidential primary election last April. What happened?
So we don't have an exact number, but basically what happened is the local elections officials around the state have to report any instances of voter fraud to the State Elections Commission. And, about 30 counties across the state reported instances of 17-year-olds voting. We got exact numbers from some counties. Other counties just said things like multiple. So the number is about 70. Across 30 counties in Wisconsin of these 17-year-olds that went and voted in the presidential primary last April, not the general election, but the primary.
So how was it that these 17-year-olds were actually able to cast a vote?
So what the Elections Commission is saying is that it's a kind of a combination of undertrained poll workers who neglected to check, the birth dates on these 17-year-old IDs when they went in to vote. And then there were also some confusing social media posts, the Elections Commission says, that were circulating around the time of the presidential primary that were telling folks that if they were 17 but were 18 by the day of the general election, that they could go ahead and vote in the primary. That is the case in some other states. It's not the case in Wisconsin. But some social media from presidential campaigns trying to promote that in other states could have bled over into things that, Wisconsin 17-year-olds could see. And then there might have been news articles along those same lines talking about 17-year-old voting in states that aren't Wisconsin, where it's legal to do so.
I mean, based on what we know, this doesn't look like allegations of widespread voter fraud. It sounds like it's 17-year-olds who were confused. Is that about the size of it?
Yeah, that's really what the Elections Commission is saying. They're saying that this is all based on anecdotal information. They said that they were getting calls. The Elections Commission was actually the Government Accountability Board back in April, before the board was abolished and replaced. But they said the Government Accountability Board was getting phone calls from confused individuals around that time saying, hey, I'm 17, I'm turning 18 before November, can I vote in the primary? Of course, official guidance was always no, that's not legal in the state of Wisconsin, but it sounds like about 70 teenagers didn't get that message, went to the polls, election workers didn't check their IDs, and thusly we had about 70 17-year-olds voting in the primary.
So are these 17-year-olds who voted in any kind of legal trouble?
So technically this is voter fraud, and voter fraud is a felony in the state of Wisconsin. What happens in this case is the local elections officials who've identified these individuals, they forward the case on to their local kind of the appropriate district attorney that would oversee these cases. The district attorneys on an individual basis decide which cases they're going to prosecute. The Associated Press did some reporting on this yesterday, and it sounds like the counties that had the most underage voters told the Associated Press that they don't intend to charge these 17-year-olds with fraud or with a felony. Rather, the Dane County District Attorney, for a more specific case, there were seven cases in Dane County, said he's reached deferred prosecution agreements with four of the seven. Deferred prosecution, for folks who might not be familiar, is where individuals can avoid a conviction if they satisfy conditions like completing community service. He didn't specify what's going on with the other three of the seven. We don't have a comment on that yet, but it sounds like the majority or at least, some of these 17-year-olds aren't going to be charged with a felony.
And Laurel, what's the action plan going forward? Is it public education for voters, or would it be also more training for poll workers?
I think more training for poll workers is something that's being discussed. When I interviewed the spokesman for the Elections Commission about this, he said that they hadn't had this problem before. There wasn't this confusion in 2008 or 2012 during the presidential elections. So I think it might be considered kind of an isolated incident tied to some of that social media, maybe some news articles. I'm not sure that folks are really expecting this to happen again. And the Elections Commission didn't receive any reports, at least as of yet. It does take some time to verify this, of 17-year-olds voting in the general election in November. So this might just be kind of a flash in the pan, a thing that happened in April, and we might not see it again.
We're talking with Laurel White right now, WPR State Capitol reporter. We're talking about yesterday's Elections Commission meeting. And Laurel, also in yesterday's meeting, a plan was approved to send out postcards to almost 800,000 voters to let them know that they might be taken off the voting rolls. So what's going on there?
That's right. So there's a part of this that's new and a part of this that's old. So every 2 years, the Elections Commission, or the statewide body that oversees elections in the state, sends out these postcards. And they send the postcards to people who haven't voted in 4 years. And if those individuals don't respond within 30 days to the postcard, they're removed from the voter rolls. So this is intended to target people who maybe have moved out of the state or who have passed away, just to keep the voter logs up to date. So that's something that we've been doing for a while. But the new thing this year is the state now has some data from what's called ERIC, the Electronic Registration Information Center. It's a national organization that states can become a part of if they choose. And Wisconsin is a fairly new member to this organization. And they have some new info about individuals who have passed away or moved. So they're sending postcards to those folks as well. The $800,000 number of people receiving these postcards is a little bit in dispute. The Elections Commission says that the total number is about 776,000, but there might be some overlap between the people that they're getting from the ERIC list and the people who haven't voted for 4 years. So 776 is the biggest number possible. It could actually be a lot smaller than that.
So if someone gets one of these postcards and says, hey, you know, I want to be registered, I want to be able to keep that registration current, what do they need to do?
So you just respond to the postcard, and then you're still registered. If you, for some reason, don't get a postcard, you're removed from the voter rolls for whatever reason, you can always re-register. And in Wisconsin, you can register actually on the day of an election at a polling place.
So is the number of people added in, well, total, who are going to be getting these postcards, is that kind of consistent with the numbers we may have expected in previous years? Or does that bump up from ERIC change the numbers quite a lot?
Right. So I asked the spokesman for the Elections Commission that today. And he said, just like turnout fluctuates in the elections themselves, the number of postcards that they send out every 2 years fluctuates too. So he said, for example, in 2012, after the presidential election, the Government Accountability Board mailed out about 300,000 of these postcards, 299,748, if we're going to get specific. So this 776,000 number is certainly much larger than that. But as I mentioned before, there could be a substantial amount of overlap between those ERIC numbers and the numbers of folks that haven't voted for 4 years. So we're not going to know exactly the number for a little bit longer.
And Laurel, as we wrap up, there's a new online portal system to register to vote online. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the Elections Commission just gave a little update on that yesterday as well. The governor signed some legislation in 2016 that would allow people to go online to register to vote in Wisconsin. You just have to have a driver's license or a state ID card. The system went live in January, but the Elections Commission just did a little demo yesterday to kind of let folks know how it's going. And according to the Elections Commission, about 1,300 people have used the system already just in the past couple of months to register online to vote.
Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter, and she joined us to talk about yesterday's Elections Commission meeting.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we look back at some of the stories of women who helped shape Wisconsin history for Women's History Month.
Right now, it's time for our weekly check-in on national politics. This week, the Congressional Budget Office released its analysis of the GOP's newest health plan. Its findings have some people worried.
The Department of Justice announced it will charge Russian spies and hackers over a massive data breach that targeted Yahoo users. And MSNBC's Rachel Maddow promised a big reveal of President Trump's leaked tax documents. But questions are being raised about what was in the documents and who leaked them.
Scott Wong is with us now to break down the news. He's a senior writer for The Hill, where he covers House Republicans and Speaker Paul Ryan. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Scott, let's talk about those House Republicans and Speaker Paul Ryan. This health care bill, big deal, a main agenda item early for Republicans in Congress, the replacement for the Affordable Care Act. This Congressional Budget Office report out says 24 million people losing insurance coverage over a decade. What are you seeing in the reaction from Republicans in the House?
Well, this adds a big complication for the speaker and for the leadership team and those trying to whip votes right now. What we're seeing is some reaction from moderate or more centrist Republicans who are turned off by these numbers. People like Ileana Ross-Leighton, who is a reliable Republican ally of the speaker's, just yesterday saying that she could not support this bill given some of the numbers of that are coming out of this CBO report. As you mentioned, 14 million uninsured by 2018, and that number would grow to 24 million additional people uninsured by 2026. So those are tough headlines for a number of Republicans around the country to swallow, particularly if they represent congressional districts where there are large numbers of constituents on Medicaid and Obamacare.
And then in the politics of this, if the speaker and other people involved in crafting this legislation adjust the plan to meet the needs of those more moderate Republicans, they are risking the Freedom Caucus, the more conservative Republicans in the House. Is that right?
Well, that's right. Speaker Ryan, in working with the White House, Donald Trump's White House, is trying to find the sort of sweet spot, if you will, of what bill can attract the most number of Republicans. Remember, Democrats have said they will not lift a finger to help Republicans pass repeal and replacement of Obamacare. So this is falling solely on Republicans to get this through the House and the Senate. And so Ryan is trying to thread the needle a little bit, finding the right balance, if you will, between what can attract the most number of Republicans in his conference. He can only really lose about 20 of his own members before opponents can kill off this bill. So it's quite a feat.
Even if he does get it through the House, there's the Senate. What are we hearing from Senate Republicans on this?
I think the sentiment in Capitol Hill right now is that the Senate is going to be a much harder lift for proponents of this bill. You've already heard a number of Republicans across the spectrum of the Republican Party, from moderates to more conservatives like Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, who are saying they just don't think this is a bill that can pass their chamber. They're nitpicking certain things. Everyone has their own issues with the bill. So you're correct. Even if this gets through the House and Donald Trump and Speaker Ryan are able to muscle it through that lower chamber, I think the bigger challenge lies in the upper chamber with the Senate.
And while this bill is being portrayed, including by Speaker Ryan, as a White House-Congress collaboration here, we've seen some Donald Trump allies turning against Paul Ryan again. Breitbart, the old stomping grounds of Steve Bannon, chief strategist now at the White House. Breitbart released audio from a conference call about a month before the election this year, released it this week in the conversation. House Speaker Ryan tells fellow members of the GOP where he stands on then nominee Trump. This is after, I think, the Access Hollywood tapes came out. Here's a listen.
I am not going to defend Donald Trump. Not now, not in the future. As you probably heard, I disinvited him from my first congressional district GOP event this weekend, a thing I do every year, and I'm not going to be campaigning with him over the next 30 days. Look, you guys know I have real concerns with our nominee. I hope you appreciate that I'm doing what I think is best for you or the members, not what's best for me.
And I think all of that information we knew back at the time, Scott, but this is the first time we're actually hearing him saying it. What's the significance of this conservative, pro-Trump during the campaign website releasing this?
That's right. We did largely know the message that Ryan was sending to his rank-and-file members on this conference call just a few weeks before the election. What's new, of course, is the actual audio tape and the fact that it has resurfaced right in the middle of this huge fight over the GOP health care repeal and replacement bill. So, you know, a lot of people, when they step back in Washington, are saying, you know, this was obviously strategically released. The timing of this is significant. It creates an added distraction or complication for Speaker Ryan as he's trying to push this bill to the finish line. And it's also reminding Donald Trump and the White House that at a very critical moment of the campaign, Ryan was not with Donald Trump. And so you could argue that it bolsters conservatives, that it weakens Ryan during a critical negotiation point on health care.
Talking about the top news in national politics with Scott Wong from The Hill. Moving on to some other issues in the news, the Department of Justice charged Russia with hacking, not related to the elections, though. That huge Yahoo data breach a couple years back, they're saying Russian officials were part of this, Russian freelance hackers apparently hired by them. What are you seeing in these charges?
Well, that's right. It's hard to keep all of these different Russian stories straight in your head, but this particular story involves the Justice Department reporting today that it's charging two Russian spies and a pair of hackers in the theft of 500 million Yahoo user accounts. This was back in 2014. I believe it was the largest sort of cyber breach in history at the time. You know, what's significant, I think, is that this is one of the first major actions of Donald Trump's Justice Department. I know that this investigation had been in the works for a number of years, but, you know, there has been this perception out there that members of the Trump campaign and his White House have been too cozy with Moscow, including the Russian ambassador to the United States meeting with many of these folks. The Attorney General himself, Jeff Sessions, had to recuse himself from a Russian hacking investigation because of a past meeting he had with this Russian ambassador. So I think this action could be seen as an attempt by the Trump administration to sort of distance itself from the Russian government and from Vladimir Putin, you know, given all of these questions swirling about the connection and ties between Trump and Moscow.
Staying with the Department of Justice for a moment, that department asking for more time to come up with evidence, information about President Trump's claims on Twitter that Trump Tower was wiretapped under President Obama's order. What is the latest there? Congress, members of Congress, congressional committees have been asking for information.
Yeah, we saw a slight development today. The chairman and top Democrat of the House Intelligence Committee speaking with reporters today, they announced that they have seen no evidence to date that the Obama administration was spying on Trump Tower during the campaign. Devin Nunes, the chairman, said he flat out doesn't believe such a thing happened. And so, you know, all eyes are going to be on James Comey on Monday, the FBI director, who will be appearing before this committee. He will testify before the House Intel Committee, and he certainly will get specific questions about whether or not the FBI requested and obtained a warrant to wiretap the Trump Tower, as Donald Trump is alleging. So it's pretty significant development in that Devin Nunes, who is closely aligned with Trump in the White House, he served on the transition team, coming out today saying that he does not believe that the Obama administration wiretapped Trump Tower.
And then Trump tax returns. People have been wondering if we'll ever see information about Donald Trump's taxes over the last bunch of years. Didn't release them during the campaign, citing an ongoing audit. Rachel Maddow of MSNBC previewed that she had some kind of tax information. A lot of people saw it as underwhelming. Two pages of taxes from 2005. What, if anything, did we learn in these tax returns?
Well, it's we learned a couple things. We learned that Trump paid about $38 million of taxes back in 2005 on $150 million of income. And I think that what that tells most people is that he, number one, pays his taxes, which had been a big question, and number two, that he's a pretty successful businessman. I mean, by all measures, that is that suggests he's pretty successful. Of course, now the big mystery is who actually leaked these documents to this particular reporter, whether these were sort of rogue IRS officials, holdovers from the Obama administration, or, as the reporter has speculated himself, was it Donald Trump himself who may have leaked these documents to a reporter in order to, you know, gain some favorable coverage showing that he pays his taxes and that he's very successful.
A lot of information out there, even for that 2005 filing, much less all the other years. What do you make of the sort of the media take on this? Rachel Maddow promoting it as a big deal, and then people compared it to, you know, Geraldo Rivera going to Al Capone's vault. Really not a lot there.
Well, I think what it shows is that we still don't have a complete picture. Remember, this is just 1 year. This is more than 10 years ago. This is back in 2005. There are only it's an incomplete picture, I think, of his total, you know, financial reports. In the past, we have seen a much more rigorous reporting of tax reports and other financial documents from our presidential candidates, let alone the president of the United States. So I think I think it's a first glimpse, and I think it raises a bunch more questions about, you know, what else is out there and whether we'll be able to see them at some point.
We'll leave it there, Scott. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
That's Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill, where he covers House Republicans and Speaker Paul Ryan. He joined us for our weekly roundup of national political news. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, the Congressional Budget Office has calculated the costs and impacts of the new House Republican health care bill. We look at what they say the proposed defunding of Planned Parenthood would mean.
First, March is Women's History Month, a month dedicated to observing the contributions of women in the United States and beyond. Now we look back at early women of Wisconsin and how their lives have impacted the state we know today.
Genevieve McBride joins us now. She's a professor emerita of history at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and she's the editor of the book Women's Wisconsin, From Native Matriarchies to the New Millennium. Genevieve, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Well, what do you hope, as a scholar of history, what do you hope gets accomplished during Women's History Month?
Lots of learning, as always. It's nice to take a little time to recognize more than half of the women today, as well as more than half of our population today, as well as more than half of the people in our past. I hope actually that people do that every month of the year, but some teachers need to be told to remember the ladies, as Abigail Adams said to John in writing our Constitution. So if we get a few weeks this month around spring break weeks or whatever, that's great.
Now, you are a specialist in Wisconsin history, among other things. What parts of women's history in Wisconsin do you think in particular deserve more attention?
The early women were absolutely marvelous. Are, of course, Native American women. This anthology starts out with the story of the woman chief of the Ho-Chunk, Hopakoakau, whose name meant the glory of the morning of Wisconsin. What a way to start a story. She was fascinating, and her descendants are still with us today. She married a French fur trader, Savoie Descartes. So when you see the name Decorah, Iowa, or the Decorah clan still today in the Ho-Chunk, Those are the descendants of the woman chief of the Ho-Chunk. And isn't it interesting? We're in a state where we still refuse to elect a woman chief today. We've had women run for governor, but we still haven't gotten back to where we were 400 years ago. So I think there are lessons to be learned from the past. And then the stories of my ancestors, because my name is actually Genevieve Gardiner McBride. I'm named for my French-Canadian grandmother, the French who came here and created the incredible Métis culture, which reigned here for 150 years until the American culture took over and replaced it, unfortunately. But until almost 1850, our society, the highest of society, were the French-Canadian and Native American Métis, the children of both cultures, a culture of incredible mutual respect, intermarriage with no question. In other words, the Native Americans welcomed the first immigrants here, the French-Canadians, from the 1600s forward. And I think we could learn a lot from that past, too. We lived together in wonderful ways in the past. And it's really only for about the last 150 years that we've abandoned that with, for example, the implementation of President Andrew Jackson's horrific Indian Removal Act, which affected this state as well as others much more. But even in this state, the tendency to import the worst of other cultures, unfortunately, took over after 1850. But even then, we have many wonderful stories, lessons from the past to be learned about how the disenfranchised in society, women and others, work together to gain their rights and gain their citizenship, almost full citizenship today, although we still don't have equal rights under the Constitution. That story's in there, too. You mentioned this anthology. It starts with the story 400 years ago. But it's not just the story of the early women. I wrote the last part, as historians haven't written it yet, to take it right up to into this new millennium, which we hope will be a better one than the last one for Wisconsin.
I want to look at some of those early days that you began with, and looking through this anthology, there are quite a number of examples of women who were doing roles that were not roles that you would think typically would be filled by women in those days, and in particular, you highlight women who were active as fur traders, especially in northern Wisconsin, on Madeline Island, around Mackinac Island. Can you tell us about some of those women?
Oh, yes. One of the first excerpts, the anthology, is to explain it to readers in hope that they might enjoy it. I don't get any royalties. They all go to the State Historical Society because it's from its articles in its magazine and in books that I drew. 45 articles that I excerpted down to nice little short readable pieces, but indicating where you can go online to read the entire article that scholars wrote in each case, but 45 of those, about hundreds of women. And the first one excerpted is the wonderful story of Therese Schindler of Mackinac, who was one of actually a family of women fur traders, people who've been to Mackinac Island and have seen the gorgeous grand old hotel there that belonged to her sister, Madeleine Laframboise. And she actually also, with her husband, was a fur trader in Milwaukee, too. They were incredibly mobile people. The trade took them up and down and around the Great Lakes and the rivers of Wisconsin. And they the good reenactments of the fur trade that can be found today, you will now see recognition that there were women fur traders, and they were very good at it. That was, again, part of the Native American and Métis culture, that the women were very involved in the economics of their societies then. So it really wasn't considered unusual then that women would be in business.
And skipping around, but in the same category of stuff you didn't know women did in Wisconsin history, lighthouse keepers was another.
Oh, I happen to live just a couple of blocks from the wonderful North Point Lighthouse, which is I got to be part of with the State Historical Society, helping to reopening it for tours on our lakefront, my beautiful Lake Michigan in Milwaukee. And the longest lasting federal government lighthouse keeper in our history was the marvelous Georgiana Stebbins, who ran that lighthouse, guided thousands of people safely into our harbor in Milwaukee, actually helped to modernize it, electrify the lighthouse, but for decades before that, she had to climb up every night and light it, as well as take the boat out sometimes to help people come in. And it's just, it's a wonderful story, and it's told beautifully at the North Point Lighthouse. I encourage people to come down to my wonderful historic neighborhood along the lakefront in Milwaukee and tour the lighthouse and see where she worked, and others too.
We're talking with Genevieve McBride right now. She is Professor Emerita of History at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and she's the editor of several books, including Women's Wisconsin, From Native Matriarchies to the New Millennium. And Genevieve, let's talk about Milwaukee and the role that women played in its founding and in getting it up and running as a city. What do we know there?
Well, I like to say that, in all the talk about city fathers, I'd like to remind people that cities and states and countries had their mothers, too. I could like to consider the founder of Milwaukee, the lovely Josette Vaugeneau, or as we say today, Juno. The Junos, all the attention goes to Lawrence Solomon Juno in other books because, of course, it has to be a man who founded cities and made history. But actually, it was her family, the Vaughs, her father before her, Jacques Vaux, and her Native American mother, Josette, was part Native American. They founded the fur trading post that then when this newcomer, Canadian, who still wasn't a citizen, so he couldn't have founded the city, if you ask me, couldn't own the land, but he married. He worked for Jacques Vaux and Solomon Juneau, married Josette Vaux, and that's how he gets the credit for founding the city. Men do that, but if when women write the history books, we can take a different look at it and say, she was here first. She was an adult by then, but she had been born and raised here while he was still up in Quebec, Canada, and she grew up here and at the family's other trading post in Green Bay, and she also saved the city while he was out gallivanting around, as fur traders had to do. She ran the fur trading post. He could only speak French for many years. She was fluent in many languages, French, English, native dialects, and the like. And she's credited with saving the city from an attack at one point. She also, very literally, was the mother of Milwaukee because she was our first midwife and helped its population boom.
And Genevieve, times are different now in terms of crediting the founder of the city. Is she getting more recognition now?
I hope so, through my work in this book. Also a book on Milwaukee history that I contributed to, also the courses I've created and taught for many years, not just on women's history, but I created a whole sequence of courses on Midwestern history, where we certainly look at Wisconsin history within it. I'm not sure if any of those courses are going to continue now, since I just retired and we're losing about a third of the faculty of our history department over the years at UW-Milwaukee, so we'll be happy to be, my successors will have to be very careful in offering the courses that students need, and there will be fewer electives like Midwestern history. But I know in the years that I taught those courses and taught these stories, women and men loved them, loved hearing more about local history. I think local history matters, not just women's history, because the lesson is that history was not just made by a bunch of guys with ponytails and tights off in Philadelphia, bless them, our wonderful founders, for the visions they had for us. But history is made wherever people are, and we all have a responsibility to know that history that was made so we stop thinking everything is brave and courageous and a first, to know what's already been done so we can do new and better things.
We're talking right now with UW-Milwaukee Professor Emerita Genevieve McBride, and she's with us today to talk stories of history from women here in Wisconsin.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are there parts of women's history in the state that you'd like to hear more about, or maybe stories from your own family or your own community about women's lives in the earlier days of Wisconsin? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're talking with UW-Milwaukee Professor Emerita Genevieve McBride. And she's with us today to talk about women's history and tell stories about that here in Wisconsin.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are there parts of women's history in the state you want to hear more about? Maybe a story from your family background that might be part of the story of women's history in Wisconsin. Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Go to our first caller now. We've got Sullivan joining us in Green Bay. Sullivan, hi.
Hi. So originally I am from Two Rivers, Wisconsin. And as far as I'm aware, that is where the ice cream sundae was invented, at the Washington House. And unfortunately, I don't really know much about the history of that. So, happen to know anything about that, Professor Genevieve?
Sullivan thinks is that one you know, Genevieve?
I read that somewhere on the internet or something. I recommend doing a little Googling. I don't think that figured into the women's history in this book, but I have come across, that tale. I should go look it up again. It's been a while since I found that, and since I've been through Trivers. My son-in-law is from Manitowoc, so I know the area well, and he's a great ice cream lover. I wouldn't be in the least surprised.
And are there, I mean, this is a big topic, but are there any inventions by women in Wisconsin that we should know about?
I am not having any come to mind right now.
It's a big subject. Although
I would say there's ideas like the Wisconsin idea itself that women played a major part in. A big part of the story, and the story actually is the entirety of my first book, was on women in our early politics and the press here. Women like Belcase La Follette, Theodora Winton Yeomans, who was featured on the cover, pioneering women journalists who also were early women suffragists, and you find out that women were very much a part of politics and of education here before they got the vote, because by being part of it, they were able to win the vote. They figured out how politics she is done, and she is so done, often done through the media. So they worked in that. Talking about family stories, I was a woman journalist in Wisconsin before I went on for my PhD at your campus and came back to my campus to teach. And I'm the daughter of a woman journalist in Wisconsin from the 1940s on. And I was taught that my mother was a pioneering woman journalist, and it was rather astonishing to keep going back through our past and find out that every generation was told they were the pioneers in journalism, medicine, law, and everything, because they were taught the alternative facts, as we would say today, of Wisconsin history rather than the actual facts, which is that women have been involved in all of those fields as well as in politics from the very start.
And Genevieve, you mentioned the Wisconsin idea, which is something, the idea with the board, is it the borders of the university or the borders of the state? And that, yep, has gone on. It's something that persists today. Can you tell us just briefly, if you would, a little bit of that story?
Well, it is, of course, credited to some wonderful minds. Actually, a colleague of mine, Professor John David Hovler, is the expert on the Wisconsin idea, and I think has talked about it recently in your city as well as mine with a new publication. And, of course, he looks at the marvelous work of John Bascom and Bob La Follette and others involved in that marvelous era of education and more in Madison. But David and I have talked, and I was appreciative that he appreciated some of my research that showed very strong influences and the partnerships that led to so many great things about our state actually were the wonderful Emma Curtis Bascom and Belcase La Follette. As a matter of fact, a little more than a century ago, when Bob La Follette became governor of Wisconsin, he referred to that period of our history as when we were governor, speaking about his marvelous wife, Belcase from Baraboo. And we find out more about them. I looked at that 1906 famous inaugural speech which is known for laying out the progressive agenda, which encompassed the Wisconsin idea and more, in this state. And it sounded familiar to me, and I went back through my notes, and I found that actually we know that Belle Case La Follette wrote her husband's speeches, that she clearly had written that one because it was 10 years old by that point. It basically was the same speech she had given in 1896 at the inaugural meeting of the Wisconsin Federation of Women's Clubs, which she helped to found. So it was actually, she laid out the progressive agenda for club women in this state. At the end of the previous century.
What a story, and we have to leave it there. Genevieve, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Genevieve McBride, Professor Emerit of History at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She's with us today. She's sharing stories of women's role in the history of Wisconsin.
Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Irish dance is booming in Milwaukee. The dancers typically keep their arms straight at their sides while their legs quickly leap, kick, and shuffle across the floor. Maureen McCollum went to investigate.
Oh, a fesh? No one knows what a fesh is. A fesh is an Irish dance competition. It is craziness, but it's a competition where kids get to come and dance. We have 930 competitors. They come, they do two steps of a dance on stage. We have reels, we have jigs, we have slip jigs, hornpipes, treble jigs, sets. I am Maura Kathleen Heck, and I'm an Irish dance teacher and owner of Cashel Dunhy School of Irish Dance in Milwaukee.
It's just really fun. You get to fly, which is awesome, and I don't know, it just takes everything else that you're stressed about away, and you just get to focus on dance.
My name's Siobhan McPhail. I'm 14. I dance with Kinsella Academy of Irish Dance, and I live in Milwaukee. I think it's definitely a sport because you need to have stamina and strength and flexibility and anything that any other athlete needs.
I'm Mariana Pop George. I'm 13 years old, and I dance for the Trinity Academy, Mequon, Wisconsin, or Milwaukee. I competed in the under-14 Open Championship category, and I just finished my treble jig. This dress, it's baby blue. It's a lot of white. It has a lot of accents on it that's like a Celtic design, and it's kind of like a tennis skirt style. And then my mom added some blue crystals along the sketching of the skirt and then to the bodice.
The dresses many years ago used to be more authentic, and they would actually had Irish designs on them from this book called The Book of Kells. They've evolved into more geometric shapes and bling, as everyone calls it. And the hair, I can't. There's folklore about, you know, oh, back in the days of ancient Ireland, like, they all curled their hair and it, so it bounced nicely as they, you know, were dancing down the aisles and dancing at the crossroads. When I was younger, we actually had to put the little pink curlers in our hair and sleep on them overnight, and your head against a window if you're driving to a fesh in Ohio. Oh, it was so painful. And then it took, you know, an hour to uncurl them in the morning. Now they're wigs and they take 5 minutes.
I like to put the wig on the Americans. My name is Sean Beglin, and I am the owner and director of Beglin Academy of Irish Dance. Before I finished high school, I was with Riverdance part-time, which still is a big Irish dance show. I left high school and got a call 2 days later that Riverdance wanted me full-time, and my first city was Milwaukee, Wisconsin, at the Riverside Theatre. We're very lucky to be in Wisconsin. What is great about this city is that in Milwaukee we have Irish dance plus Irish music plus Irish singing plus Irish language. That we have Celtic studies. There is such a bloodline of Irish running through this area of America that you can't get away from it.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Coming up, the Congressional Budget Office's report about the costs associated with the new GOP health care plan includes the impact of eliminating federal funding for Planned Parenthood. We'll find out what they found coming up here on Central Time.
An internal office debate here at Central Time turned out to be a burning question on the national scene. A cooking website hosted a debate on the topic, are green beans finger food?
Backstory here, Rob, one day you had a big pot of green beans.
Well, it's not a big pot. I had a little container of leftover.
I remember it is a big pot. And you proceeded
to... kettle. This is vast... kettle of green beans.
Anyway, you just proceed to pull them out and eat them with your fingers.
Right, not a fork. Right. They're cold, you know, and you were a little weirded about Amanda Magnus, our producer, who eats a lot of vegetables, but raw vegetables.
Green pepper every day.
Right. That's okay to eat with your fingers, but cooked green beans, it offended some people, and apparently does on the national stage, too, to eat green beans
it
with your fingers.
Something about... You can't do it. It's a bad memory. I'm going to have to move through it.
It was difficult to watch.
Let's just say that.
But I mean, you know, you stab each individual green bean with a fork and eat it, or like cut it up with a knife all daintily, reach into your vast kettle of green beans. Veronica isn't holding this together too well. I'm gonna put this out there now. Anyway, you can weigh in. Send us a note on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Do you eat green beans as finger food? Is it acceptable? Would you be weirded out to the point of incoherence, as certain talk show hosts apparently are? This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.